What's up with WhatsApp and teenagers? I'm David Brancaccio in New York. The U.S. has been increasingly looking to Europe as a model for how to regulate internet companies. And there's word WhatsApp, a handy way to text and do voice and video calls using encrypted Wi-Fi, is cutting off kids under 16 in Europe. The old limit there was 13. WhatsApp is owned by Facebook, but the supply is only to Europe. My marketplace colleague, the BBC's Anu Anand, is following this from London. Hi, Anu.
Hi, David.
All right, so it's the under 16 crowd, under 16 years old, affected by this?
That's right. When WhatsApp rolls out a new terms of service and an updated privacy policy in the next few weeks, users in the European Union will get a little prompt to say, do you confirm that you're 16 years or older? There are already a huge number of young people on WhatsApp. There aren't any EU-specific numbers, but just to give you an idea, a third of all UK-based 12 to 15-year-olds are active on WhatsApp, and that's according to a government report. The new European regulations say that personal data can only be lawfully held on a child when they're at least 16 years old. You can have younger users on social media when a member state decides that the lower end 13 to 16 is allowed. But WhatsApp seems to be taking a pretty broad across-the-board policy and saying, we're not really set up to verify users' age, so we're just going to stick to the letter of the law.
I think of WhatsApp for its fancy pants encryption. I don't know why under 16s need that, but is the under 16 crowd going to miss this?
My goodness, if you judge the reaction based on Twitter, oh yes, there's been lots of it. One tweet here in front of me, massive sobs and snot bubbles for the last half hour from my teenage daughter. That's when one parent here in Britain heard the news. Another parent making the point that her 13-year-old uses WhatsApp with her classmates to check in on how they're feeling, on homework. So, you know, a lot of kids are already on it, and a lot of them are going to feel shut out if they can't use it any longer.
All right. I'm still recovering from the parents' image so sketched in that tweet. My marketplace colleague, the BBC's Anu Anand in London, thank you.
Thanks a lot, David.
Now, people in the pharmaceutical business are all agog about news today of a likely merger. Takeda of Japan could pay $56 billion for Shire, which operates out of the U.S. but has a tax headquarters in Ireland. Among the biggies in Shire's portfolio, the attention deficit drug Adderall and a range of medicines for very rare diseases. Meanwhile, Mr. Takeda started selling traditional Japanese and Chinese medicines back in 1781 and ramped up to manufacturing diarrhea and malarial drugs in 1895. If Takeda Shire goes through, it would be the biggest foreign purchase by a Japanese company ever. Let's check the markets. After the Dow fell 424 points yesterday, 1.75%, stock index futures are down moderately this morning, -0.3% for Dow and S&P futures. Some contend the sell-off was triggered by higher interest rates, with the benchmark 10-year yield, as we've been reporting early and often, crossing above 3% for the first time in 4 years. You count on Marketplace to keep you informed about the economy and then some. And it's not only what we talk about, but how we talk about it in a practical, objective, and sometimes unexpected way. Now, we feel it's important work that we're already doing, but with your support, we can do more of it and reach more people as well. For as little as $5 a month, become a Marketplace investor. And right now, your donation will go twice as far thanks to a $4 match from Candida. Time's running out on that challenge, so if you could donate today at marketplace.org, and thank you for the support. Yesterday, we talked to political scientist Ian Bremmer, who has a new book out about globalism on the ropes, something he argues goes way beyond President Trump. The venerable news magazine The Economist is also wrestling with this. It was founded in part on the principle of freer trade, what the Brits call liberal values. The magazine turns 175 this year, and it started something called Open Future to ask people, what are society's values at this moment in history? Zanny Minton-Beddoes, editor-in-chief of The Economist, joins us here. Zanny, I hold an American passport, so when you say liberal, I think certain things. But you and the gang over there are liberals of a different stripe?
I'm a classic English liberal, a classic English liberalism of the sort that The Economist was founded to champion and still espouses. Is about open societies and free markets. It's guided by the values that were written about by great thinkers such as John Stuart Mill, a belief in progress, a distrust of powerful interests, and respect for individual freedom.
And you're very much worried, hence the initiative in The Economist here, that your kind of liberalism is getting trampled by such forces out there as populism.
As I reflected on us turning 175, it struck me that right now is a time where, for different reasons, that sort of liberal worldview, classical liberal worldview, having really been in the ascendancy for quite a long time, is now under quite considerable criticism and attack from different quarters. And it's partly, I think, been driven by a sense that the liberal elite, if you will, have been sort of running the world for a while and made a lot of mistakes. And I think there are a lot of things that people are justifiably unhappy about.
But among the things you have to address is, if not at the center, near the center of your classic liberalism, is the idea of open markets, freer trade. How did that work out for many people? It didn't lift all boats.
As societies, we have insufficiently thought about what to do to retrain those people, assist those people, help those people cope with the 21st century economy. And it's trade and technology, if you will, because the impact on people is somewhat similar, whether your job is displaced by imports or whether it's displaced by automation. If you look at what we're going through now, it's very similar to many of the disruptions that affected the late 19th century, early 20th century economy, when we had a similar industrial revolution, a similar scale of change. And if you look then at the degree to which social and economic policies dramatically changed it, whether it was the introduction of progressive taxation, whether it was universal secondary education, all kinds of very big changes happened, often, I may say, pushed by radical liberals. That's the scale of the conversation that I think we need to be having about what is the nature of the sort of society and policies we need to create for the early 21st century.
The Economist, celebrating its 175th year. The editor, Zanny Minton-Bettos, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Our producers are Justin Ho, Katie Long, and Daniel Shin. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.